And now it is my pleasure to introduce Michael.
Wait, I'm Michael and I'm an alcoholic. It's funny, the first speaker I ever heard was this woman, Grady O, from Sacramento, and she opened, and I was like 6 months sober, and I was all about, like, you know, all the angels that were in AA. And she started her story, she said, "I finally found out who goes to AA meetings, the same assholes who don't." And I was like, "Oh, how dare you speak about these glorious people." But my name is Michael, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a real alcoholic, and I'm a fifth generation Irish Catholic drunk. All the men in my family were drinkers, and both of my brothers are alcoholics. One is currently experiencing his bottom, and one has been sober for quite some time. You know, I was thinking about, it's been a minute since I've told my story, and when I really think about it, my story today doesn't have a lot to do with how I got here. It has everything to do with why I've stayed here, because I've been sober for a minute. New adventures in recovery never fade. And back in 2019, my mother called me and she said, "I can't take care of your dad anymore by myself." And I said, "Well, you know, give me a day to clean out the refrigerator, you know, and I'll come home." And I've been there going on 6 years. But what's interesting is it's the house that I grew up in, where all my cuckoo and crazy started. And in the back of my mind, knew that I had been raised in an alcoholic family. My father was never violent, but he was very passive-aggressive, and the effects that that had on my life were very subtle. And although I had made amends to my parents years ago, there were many pieces of my puzzle that were missing from my childhood. And going back in that environment with a new pair of glasses, so much began to make sense. And I eventually had to move my parents into a facility because my mother has Alzheimer's and my father is wheelchair-bound. So it just got to a point where I couldn't take care of them by myself. Got them settled, and then my older brother bonded out, so he's with me. But what's interesting is that I'm not a gossip. I just gather intelligence. And I don't snoop, but if something is in a drawer, it's important probably that I find out what that is to make sure my parents medically are being taken care of. So anyway, my mother had this journal that said, "Do not under any circumstance read this." Come on. So yeah, I read it cover to cover. But like, I was finding all this crazy stuff. I found all of these letters that my mother had written to my dad's mistresses, which I knew nothing about the mistresses, like at all. And yet they were all his secretaries. And so, you know, and it's so weird. Like I've been single all these years, and I have so many friends that are like, you know, "Why aren't you in a relationship?" Well, truthfully, I'm an artist by nature, and I don't want anybody shit in my house. And I don't want anybody on my back going, you know, "What do you want?" I'm like, "Just leave me alone. I'm being creative." So there you go. And the first time I told my story, like in the sex inventory, well, see, I came out the year AIDS hit. So by the time I came into AA, all of my friends were dead except one person. So my choice was like have sex and possibly die or just don't go there. So the first time I told my story, I was so embarrassed that I had not had like 20 catastrophic alcoholic relationships that I just made up relationships and just went on and on about these tragic, dramatic breakups that didn't exist. So I'm officially making amends that I won't do that this time around. But yeah, when I was a kid, I was very introverted. I was the little kid that would kind of hide behind his mom's skirt. People kind of frightened me. And one of the things that really plagued me when I was young was that I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. I never felt like I fit in. There were two things when I was young. I just wanted to be a grown-up, and I just wanted to be fabulous. And I went to great lengths to become fabulous. But what I know today is I did it utterly at the expense of everything that was me to the core. I did a lot of things that I don't have shame because they're kind of funny now. Like, I pushed a Pinto over the Cooper River Bridge in Charleston in stiletto heels. And,
I love that.
And, it went into the river. I had help. I had two other drag queens to help me. But Yeah, and so I wanted to fit in, and I was in, because I was gay in the 70s and early 80s, you know, I didn't know what all that was about. I mean, there wasn't, you know, nobody talked about it. And it wasn't that my parents never were condemning of that. It's just that, like really? Like, I'm attracted to guys? Ew. You know, I didn't know what to do with that. So, at a very young age, I started hiding out. And, you know, the Big Book talks about us being, you know, the directors. And when I was in fifth and sixth grade, I was bullied a lot. And I went to my mom. She was like, well, just punch him in the face. So I broke this kid's nose when I was in sixth grade. And, oh, it felt good. You know, I think that's when I, like, tapped into that, like, anger and rage that alcoholics love. You know, it's like the Big Book talks about resentments. And, oh, my God, group resentments are the best. When you can get all your friends. Like, well, so-and-so said so-and-so. It's like fourth graders on playground. And that happens in the rooms. But anyway, in sixth grade, they had initiated intramural festivities for a weekend where each class competed with another in different sports stuff. Well, I didn't want to, like, climb ropes or do any of that. But when the teacher was like, you know, do we have ideas? Because everybody had to have a team name, and you know, you had to come up with a theme. And I was, and I'm severely dyslexic. So when I was in school, when I was being taught something that I couldn't comprehend a practical need for, I just, like, stared out the window and created fabulous places in my mind that I could go when I just needed to check out. And it was that alcoholic, that disassociation, that we use alcohol to escape whatever we're feeling. Well, that behavior was instituted in me when I was in sixth grade. The teacher was like, well, Michael, what do you think? And I was like, I think we should be called Nick's Knights, and we should be like the Knights of the Round Table. And outside there's a wooded area, and we should set up tents, and we should hang out like the knight, like Robin Hood and the Knights of the Round Table, and we should carry banners that have Nick's Knights, and we should print T-shirts. Well, of course, all the kids were like, yeah, like that's so cool. So I learned that if I could make other people look better than me, then the focus would be taken off of me. And that started a lifelong trend of doing that, because I was a doormat. You know, if you wanted to, you know, screw me over, you know, do it. So, you know, I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. So that started. So I was hiding out from who I genuinely was, and I was making everybody look better just to survive and get through things. And when after I graduated, I went to a two-night program at the Art Institute of Atlanta, which were primarily adults that wanted to change their careers. So I got drunk. We went to Dante's Down the Hatch on Peachtree, and I got blistered and really drunk. And, you know, what I know today is when it came to being introverted, and I think most alcoholics are introverted extrovert or extroverted introverts, that we use alcohol to, like, let the walls down. And truthfully, alcohol gave me wings, but it turned around and took away the sky. And it took 10 years to do that. When I got done with that, I need to go to school and get to please my parents and get, like, a real degree. So I chose the College of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina, which is a beautiful, beautiful campus. It's a magnificent city. It's cultured and fabulous, but you can get into a hell of a lot of trouble in Charleston, South Carolina. And the girl that I was dating at the time, bless her heart, took me to the first gay bar I went to, and I guess she would classify as a classic fag hag. And bless her heart, she was so in love with me. But when I walked in, this drag queen walked in, and she had this white turban on and this white flowing cape and stilettos and a kind of a fancy version of Hillary Clinton pantsuit. And I was like, oh, she is fabulous. And in that moment, I was like, because I realized when she walked in, every single person in the club dropped what they were doing and were like, she's here. And I thought, you know, I could do that. I could do that. So I became, and I know that it's an outside issue, but I'll use the word once, I became a cocaine dealing drag queen. Fabulous. Exactly. And I had this blue, this silver sequin dress that had gigantic, like, Dolly Parton boobs. But the boobs were hollow. And I kept baggies in one boob, and I put cash in the other. And I was just worth the club. Now, the problem was that they were bringing the cocaine in on the nuclear subs via the U.S. Navy. So if anybody tells you that our military is not involved in the trafficking of drugs, it is a lie. So a few of the, and truthfully, you know, when I said, I was like, that was not really a good career move. Did that for a while, but a couple people, like, got in trouble and somebody, like, got a bullet. So I was like, okay, maybe this is not a good career choice. But I wanted to be in theater in some capacity, and I worked in the film and theater industry as a costume designer for 20 years. I had a very successful career. And there's an official story of how I got into that, and then there's what actually happened that got me into that. And I had attended the mayor's masked ball in Charleston, South Carolina. I was in high drag, and I was in the men's bathroom with my skirt hiked up, standing in the urinal doing my business. And this old man came in, and he's, like, checking me out, like, ooh, gross, like, you nasty old man. And, you know, gave him a finger, and I left. And my friends were like, do you know who that was? I was like, some dirty old man. They're like, no, that's Giancarlo Minotti, the famous Italian opera composer who's in town. That's what this ball is for, because he's bringing a new production to Spoleto. And I'm like, oh, shit. So I dusted myself off and powdered my nose and made nice. And I went to his table, and he said, hi. And he said, well, you know, hello, what do you do? And I lied. I was like, I'm a costume designer. Well, oh, my God, no lie. The man got me a job designing part of the production for his show the next season. And ironically, that gave me the credential to start a 20-year career as a costume designer. So that's the real story. So I did that, kept drinking. You know, drinking, it's like I could go on and on. Of course, there was the thing with the Pinto on the bridge. Truthfully, that should be filmed. That was me and we stole a Pinto. And it was down on the bridge, but it broke down, like, on the incline before we had gotten to the top. And it would hit, like, just like it was teetering on the top. And there was a nuclear sub coming in down the river. So, of course, we were exhausted. I mean, we were in stilettos and, like, fancy dresses and headpieces. And we thought, well, you know, okay, let's take a break. Let's smoke a cigarette and watch the nuclear sub come in. So this picture, three drag queens looking at the bridge, smoking a cigarette. Well, behind, the Pinto starts moving. And we didn't know the Pinto was moving. And by the time we realized, it was, like, halfway down the other side of the bridge, it was like into the water. And now, did we panic? We were like, no, let's just walk home, because our place was just across the bridge. And there was a 24-hour Kroger that had two employees, and there were always four or five of us. And we would go to Kroger, and we had this girlfriend named Eat 'Em Up Gourmet. And she was a prostitute, worked out the Navy base. And she was kind of a large girl, but she could take a whole ham and hold it between her legs and walk out of the store. And she was a great cook. So three of us would entertain the staff while the other drag queens went and stole dinner. And we would go home and just party and cook it up. And eventually that came to a rip-roaring end. And it was my first bottom. I realized, I'm like, okay, this just is not working out. So I came back to Atlanta, got a position with a company here that made costumes, and the rest of my drinking story was just, because I was a club kid, was working. I did have a job, but every night was in the clubs, just getting wasted. Everybody knows what that's about. No need to go into that anymore. So I woke up one morning, and it was a Monday morning, and I'm not really sure what I had done the weekend before. But it was not nice, it was not pretty, and I was really messed up. And I stopped in front of my vanity mirror. When I looked at myself in the mirror, I didn't know who was looking back. And I distinctly remember that morning saying, God, I cannot live like this anymore. Now, I have not had a drink since. And it took me a number of years in AA to understand what had actually happened that morning. When I was going through my family's papers, my dad was he was an attorney, but he was a historian, and he really documented a lot of family stuff. And my great-grandfather, who was a classic alcoholic drunk, his father was who first came from Ireland, and it's documented that they brought two cows and a horse. I'm like, well, Dad, they must have been, like, you know, a family of means to have done that. And he was like, oh, they probably just stole them before they got on the boat. which is true. I'm sure that's what they did. But there was a Catholic organization that was an abstinence organization that was a precursor of the Oxford group up north. It was called the Cadets of Sacred Heart. And when I was going through the files, I found this newspaper clipping from 1892, and when the men would join this, they had their little cadet outfits, but they would put an announcement in the damn newspaper that, you know, get sober. And he was inducted on February 6th of 1892. Now, the thing that's really ironic is I went to my first meeting on February 6th, 1992, exactly 100 years to the day from when my great-grandfather got sober. So, coincidence? No. And all these years I've been sober, I knew nothing about that. Another thing, like a total God thing. When I came in, I got a fabulous first sponsor, and my first three steps went pretty quick. I told her what had happened, and, you know, I know for myself that morning in front of the mirror, that was my first step. I had surrendered. You know, I knew, even though it was a moment of clarity, I knew that I could not function anymore like that. When it came to God, I had some issues, a few issues. My sponsor used to tell me, oh, she was like, you are so damn angry. I'm like, I'm not angry, God damn it. but I was, you know, I was angry at everything. And she said, and she was brilliant. She said, you know, before we get into this, like, fourth step thing, she said, I really think, she said, you need to do a God inventory. And I'm like, a God inventory? And she said, yeah. She said, I want you to spend some time. And she said, you know, did you believe in God when you were a kid? I said, yeah, of course I did. And she said, well, I want you to think about that. And I did. And when we met next, and I had done some writing and journaling about it, she framed it. She said, when was the youngest you were where you felt a presence of something outside of your family? And I said, well, I thought about it. I wrote about it. And truthfully, it was when, and I had to have been maybe two, maybe three at the most. And we were at the cathedral in Buckhead. And I can remember my father would hold me. So I was faced away from the altar. I was looking back at the organ. And the stained glass windows were just beautiful. I can remember looking at the sun coming through the windows and how beautiful they were. And when we would go down the aisles, I would always put my hand on the stone because it was so cool. It was very cold. And I would stand with my back against it because it was so cool. And when the organ would play, there was the reverberation of the bass. With all of that, as a child, I can remember thinking, there's something different about inside this place that's different from outside. And I shared that with my sponsor, and she said, that's good. She's like, that's enough. Because when I turned around, and it was preachers telling me what I needed to think and what I needed to believe, I just kind of checked out. I mean, when I was born, I was like, okay, Mary got pregnant, you know, poof. You know, and, you know, popped out Jesus, and he had this really cool life, and he was a cool dude, you know, he took care of people, and that was enough for me. I didn't need anything more than that. So that was where I started. Now, I've done chakras and Buddha and my little altar at home. I have Kuan Yin, Buddha, and chimes and ding-ding-dings, and when I'm feeling stressed, I light it all up. Because I believe in covering all my bases. So I can't really describe what my HP is, and I don't think anybody really can. But if somebody wants to talk to me about their journey with that, you know, I'm happy to do it. You know, the 12th step says that having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. So the message of AA consistently from beginning to end is about finding a higher power and believing in that and having faith in that. When I got to my fourth step, I was the two pretty big four steps. The first one was with my first sponsor. The second one was the one that really I got into nitty gritty. You know, I was so disconnected from any kind of reality. When I did my first fourth step, I could equate like the things that went down that were bad that happened during the period of time that I was really getting messed up. A lot of that, the behavior started before that. So my second inventory, I got into that. You know, the big book tells us, and I think it's one of the most important statements in the whole book, it says we have to get to the causes and conditions. Because if we don't get to the causes and conditions, you know, we're not going to know what it is behaviorally that we need to change. Second inventory, I had all these resentments, like pages and pages of resentments. And my second sponsor had lived his life in Japan and had been an English professor and had moved back to Atlanta. And I was having issues with, my ego was still not in check. I thought I was just the most unique thing in the world. And he called me over before I did my fourth step, and in his living room, he had this little table that was like down by the, and little pillows, and it was painted like this really gay yellow, canary yellow. Yeah. Really gay room. And in the center of the table was this little, this beautiful like blood red porcelain dish of sand. We sat down and he had these little chopsticks, and he was like Mr. Miyagi with the chopsticks. And he reached into the bowl and like picked up some sand and was like, tick, 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 and ended up with like one grain of sand in the chopsticks. And he said, give me your hand. So he put the grain in my hand. And he said, now I'm going to leave you alone. He said, I want you to think of that one grain as the entirety of who you are. Your heart, your soul, your desires, your loves, your hates. Think of that grain of sand as you. I'm like, okay. So he left me alone for about 15 minutes, and I'm like, well, hello, little grain of sand. Yeah. And so I did what he told me to do. I didn't think a second about it. And he came back in, and he took the chopsticks, was like, you know, picked it up, and he dropped it back in the bowl of sand. And then he took the chopsticks, and he stirred the sand up, and he poured the whole bowl out on top of the table. And he said, I want you to find your grain of sand. And I was like, knowing full well I couldn't, and that was the lesson. I wasn't special. There wasn't anything about me that was any different from any other person that walks the face of the earth. And still to this day, when I get into the me, you know, the big book talks about it, you know, self will run riot. When I think that the world should revolve around me, I always think of that grain of sand, and I'm like, you know, I'm just not that important. There's not a person. When I get angry at the teller at the grocery store and I think everybody's against me, she didn't give a shit. She's working her ass off. And I'm probably being an asshole to her. You know, and, you know, I'm not that important. And I so needed to learn that in recovery. Because until I learned that, I didn't have a chance in hell of breaking beyond my ego to find out who it was that I am. Now, I'm loud and boisterous, and yeah, I'm one of the assholes of AA. Anyone who spends any time talking to me knows that there's a place for that. It's like, if I can be entertaining enough for you to listen to what I'm saying, but if you can get your little piece of sand out of it, then I've done my job. And the other thing with humility is there have been many people who have come into these rooms that absolutely, to the core of my being and my heart, I wanted them to get sober, and they didn't. And what I know about that is 99.999% of the people that I meet in these rooms, I am not the chosen messenger. Now, I can do my best, and I can share my story, but the only thing I have is my story. And if somebody takes that and does something with it, fine, that's beautiful. But if they don't, that's not about me. It's like everyone needs to find their connection. And the other most important line that's in the big book is the paragraph before a vision for you. And I'm paraphrasing because I'm dyslexic, I can't memorize shit. But it's talking about, you know, being concerned that when those who have gone before us are no longer around, you know, what are we going to do? And the big book says, you will create the fellowship you crave. If you're in a meeting and you don't connect with people in that meeting, go to another meeting. You know, you'll find your peeps. And as I've slowly discovered who I was, then I began to find who my peeps are. The beauty of AA is we're all each other's peeps, but we let our egos get in the way. We let our judgment get in the way. We go like, oh, shit, I got to listen to that story again, get in the way. And it's one of the reasons that I've always tried to go to meetings where there are a lot of new people, because honest to God, it's the newcomer that's 5 days off the cuckoo train that will share something so honest and so deep and so real, and they don't even know what they shared. But I do, because I've been there, and it means something to me. You know, a lot of my friends are like, why do you still got AA meetings? Well, if everybody that got sober left AA, there wouldn't be any AA. It's important to me. Not because I'm some kind of special guru, but, you know, I needed a lot of different kinds of people. I needed the people that pissed me off, and I needed people that I loved. You know, when I was early, I caught this huge resentment towards this woman, and she just was not going to behave. She was not behaving right. And I just knew if she would listen to me and do things my way, she would be much happier, and so would I. So I talked to my sponsor about it, and I had gone, like, ran this tape in my head, and I had this conversation with her, which I, of course, never included her in. And I thought, I agreed, I will go talk to her. And I figured in my head, if I can just explain to her what a horrible person she is, she will embrace me and say, thank you. I will change everything about me so that you are happy. And so I did that. And damned if she looked at me, she did not skip a beat. She said, Michael, yeah, you obviously have a real resentment towards me. What are you going to do about it? And I was like, what? Me? And I had learned it was so important that people tell me my truth when I came in, because I couldn't see it. Sometimes that rubbed me really wrong, but they loved me enough to tell me the truth. These people are like, oh, you can't take anybody's inventory. Well, hell, that could kill them. You know, it's important. It's important, you know, for my sponsors to say, you're being a real ass, Michael. Like, what's going on? And it's also why it's so important to go to in-person meetings. Because if you don't have a home group and you don't get to know enough people that understand your behavior, that when you're acting out or when I'm acting out and I don't even know I'm acting out, they can call me on it and say, what is going on? Because you are behaving now the way you say you used to behave when you were using. And inevitably over the years, when I have witnessed that in somebody, they have already relapsed in their head. It's just a matter of time before they're out the door. And as far as my resentments, getting back to my resentment list, it was endless. And this guy from Japan, he was like, Michael, he was like, have you like checked out the seven deadly sins and the 12 and 12? I'm like, what? And, you know, pride, anger, envy. He said, well, what I want you to do, he said, this is a very thorough list. He said, but I want you to take this list of these seven little things, and I want you to start drawing a line of what you're describing and see. And of course I went through the whole list, and everything that I thought was different or weird about me all compiled into those seven little things. And he gave me a necklace that had seven Aurora Borealis crystals on it. And he said, I want you to wear this until you don't need to wear it anymore, because you need to do some work on your character defects. And he said, the reason that the beads are Aurora Borealis is that in the sunlight, and depending on where the bead turns, it always looks like it's a different bead, but it's the same bead. And he said, I want you to wear that. And I wore that for a good 4 years, and every night I would take it off and put it at my bedside table. One night I reached to take it off, and it fell apart. Like, it just fell apart in my hands, and the beads just went everywhere. So I thought, okay, maybe my HP was like, okay, you've done a good job. You've really looked at these things. But when it comes to, you know, admitting to God, to ourselves, you know, I needed to do that. It was, when I did my fifth steps, it wasn't that I was like, oh, you know, because truthfully, to this day, if I saw a burning bush, I'd pee on it to put it out. You know, so sponsors have always told me, just pay attention. You'll know when God's talking to you. But the process of telling someone else the things that I was ashamed of, the things that I had fear over, just took the power of that away. I did my best to try to allow God into my life, my higher power, and I call my higher power God. You know, I tried to do that in my amends. There were some amends that I was unsure about. I went over my amends list with my sponsor, and what's interesting, and it's where I started seeing God work in my life, because there was the, like, 10 major amends. There was not a single person that I had to sing out, God wronged me. There was a woman that I worked with years ago when I was a teenager that I had stolen from, and I worked in this company in Buckhead, and I had not seen this woman in 20 years, and literally out of the blue, she just walked in, and she was asking for directions. I said, Betty? And she was like, Michael? I pulled her aside. I said, look, you know, I've gotten sober. I just need to tell you that, you know, I stole from you. You know, what can I do to pay you back? She said, knowing that you are taking care of yourself is enough. And that pretty much was the response that I got from people that I did that with. And it was random, weird. Just for one time, the airport in Chicago, of all things, waiting to board a plane, and this guy that I owed an amends to, like, walked right by me, and, like, literally out of the blue. It was, and to this day, I'm like, okay, God's got my back. It's a process. I wish that I could say that it was easy. You know, I don't tell newcomers it's going to get better, because it gets weird. Seriously. And I tell them, I said, it's going to be uncomfortable, it's going to get weird, but you don't have to drink. And I think that's an honest thing to tell someone who's getting started. And, you know, with time and kind of getting a groove and working the steps, yeah, I can deal with anything. I mean, Lord knows. I used to start my story, because I have two brothers. I used to say, well, my older brother did everything right. My little brother did. I did everything wrong, and my little brother had choices. And, you know, of course, the weird thing is, my older brother is currently having his bottom, and his life has been a disaster. My little brother got sober 14 years ago, and having done the spiritual work and the work, I'm the one in the family who's turned out to be, like, the responsible one that's taking care of my parents. Never in a million years would I have thought that that would have been the case. And I think part of my working the steps and being engaged in recovery, it put me, I have spent most of my adult life in situations talking with people honestly about what's really going on. And, you know, I truly believe that children are the most cherished, honest, pure beings on the earth. But we live in a world, children see the world exactly for what it is, but we live in a world that keeps telling us that's not what we're seeing. And it messes us up. It did me. And particularly being in an alcoholic family. The last three steps. The tenth step, you know, continue to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admit it. Now, I thought that was the loophole step, which meant that I could cut the fool and just be an asshole because I could always go back and pray and meditate and apologize later. That's not what it's about. That's not what it's about. You know, I'm supposed to do that daily. And I can say today that a lot of time doesn't cross. When I find that I have, like, overstepped a boundary that I need to make amends for, you know, I'm pretty quick to do it. And the other thing about the amends thing, particularly when it comes to working with people in the program, what I have found is if something I have said to somebody has upset them, that sometimes what amends is required is that I need to make amends for my delivery, not for what I said. The 11th step, softer prayer meditation. Like I said, I have this little, like, thing at home, and I've got Buddha, and I rub his belly, and I've got chimes and incense. And I'm a firm believer in, like, covering all your bases. I did grow up Catholic, so, you know, Virgin Mary and Jesus and, you know, all the apostles, and God knows all the saints that they have. They have a saint for everything. I encourage people to explore. You know, I thought that living a spiritual life for years was that the spiritual life was going to be like, poof, you know, spiritual, okay, I'm happily ever after. But for me, what it has become is true spirituality, it's simply the continued act of seeking. Because God reveals himself to me in many different ways. And if I think there's only one way, then I'm probably not seeing all this going on over here. And like I said, God mostly talks to me through newcomers. Because like I said, it's the newcomer that says something that is so divinely honest and pure, and I need to hear that. We old timers, we can talk the same shit like every damn meeting. You know, the point people are like, stop, we've heard the stories in time. But I need to be in the environment of new people. Because when I talk to a new person, if I'm not practicing what I'm preaching, I immediately know I am talking a bunch of bullshit to them. You know, but when I talk about my experience and what I've been willing to do, and ironically, when I'm talking truth, they really listen. Because they know if I'm pulling their leg. I love the newcomer like myself that comes in here thinking, you know, how can I play this room? You know, because I know today I can walk into a room full of 1,000 people, and in 5 minutes I know exactly who I need to be to fit in and be fabulous. But that don't necessarily jive with who I am, because there are a lot of places today I don't need to be going, and there are a lot of people I don't need to be hanging with. You know, 12-step, the spiritual awakening for me in some ways was very fast when it comes to my behavior. Oh, my character defects, I rode every one of those bitches till the wheel fell off, you know. And then I would say, oh, I'll let go of it now. And I know there are a lot of people in here that can share that with me. But it's a beautiful program. I love the last paragraph of the vision for you. Because the last paragraph of the vision for you, that's the program. But I needed 164 pages to explain to me what that meant. So I'm so pleased that there are people here. I hope that maybe you heard something that you can identify with. And bless you as you trudge the road to happy destiny. Thank you.
First I slip, and then I trip to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into me where the promises are.